Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 16th of May. Obesity and severe obesity forecast through 2030 was published recently in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. The obesity prevalence in this country has increased dramatically since the 1970s. The National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey shows the obesity prevalence in 2007-2008 was a 33.8% 100% increase was 33.8%, which was a 100% increase from 1976 to 1980 and a 50% increase from 88 to 94. Obesity prevalence, this is perhaps the good news in all of this, might be leveling off for some adult subpopulations, but severe obesity has increased faster than obesity with no evidence of slowing. The relationship between excess weight, poor health, and high medical expenditures will be one of the issues that we're looking at this hour. We'll also, of course, be looking at how do we take on the obesity epidemic, how do we lose weight in this country, and one of our guests says that one of the problems is the obesity epidemic is caused by overproduction of food in the United States. We'll have three guests with us this hour, and I'm sure we'll have many phone calls because struggling with weight is an issue that many Americans face, and it's a very difficult one. We're going to start the hour with a guest who was very heavily involved in that study that I just mentioned, Obesity and Severe Obesity Forecasts through 2030. Our phone number, I should tell you, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can also use the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page if you would like to leave messages. Olga Havzhu is a research economist from RTI International, which is a nonprofit research institute headquartered in North Carolina. And Olga was one of the people involved in that obesity and severe obesity forecast through 2030. Olga, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Kathleen, for having me on the show.
Yeah, our great pleasure. Well, these statistics, even though we may see a bit of a leveling off, are so dramatic, aren't they? So many people in this country are obese. And when you look at how the number has gone up in the past 20 years, it's just phenomenal.
Yes, exactly. There has been dramatic increases in the obesity rate in the last 20 years or so. And then what we predict is that even though there might be slight slowdown in the growth of the obesity rate, but it's still going to increase even for the next 20 years.
Mm-hmm. And you also look very carefully at the relationship between obesity, poor health, and the amount of money that we spend individually and as a country on very high medical expenditures.
Exactly. And actually, a part of this study that you mentioned earlier, we looked at if the obesity rates were to remain at the levels that they are at now, we would be saving about $550 billion in medical expenditures. So if there's no increase and we stay at the 2010 levels, that's how much money the country would be able to save in medical expenditures. So, and that's a huge, obviously, amount of money.
And where are we spending that money? Obesity causes what kinds of medical problems?
It is very strongly related to a number of diseases. For example, diabetes, various heart diseases, arthritis, asthma, and other medical conditions as well.
Mm-hmm. You have looked at, and let's look at the good news here, some of the good news. There is a recent evidence, your study says, of slower growth. And I'm wondering what might be causing that. Did the study look at that? Are we changing the way that we eat? Are we eating less junk food and eating healthier foods? Are we going to fast food restaurants less often? Or what's going on?
I'm actually not really sure. The study didn't look at that specifically, the reasons for some of the recent slowdowns in the obesity growth. But we did look at how basically when we projected our future forecasts, we took into account the fact that most recently there have been some slowdowns. Our study is different from the previous research that has been done on forecasts of obesity rates, is in that in previous research, linear trends were just extended into the future without taking into account kind of the curving that has happened maybe in the last couple of years or the last 2 years. And we in our study took that into account and kind of relaxed this assumption that the growth will continue at the current trends linearly.
So when the
predictions that we came up with for the next 20 years are actually slightly lower than what has been done in previous research, but we still predict that the obesity rate will go up by about 33% between now and 2030. And that's just for obesity, which we define as body mass index of 30 or greater. And what we found for severe obesity, which is defined as body mass index of about 40 or over, and that's an average probably people who are at least 100 pounds or so over their normal weight. That rate is expected to grow even faster. We predict that it will increase by 130% from a current rate of about 5% to going all the way up to 11% in 2030.
Ooh. Well, that's scary. That's scary, isn't it?
Yeah, and the problem is that the association that I mentioned earlier between obesity and other health problems is even worse for individuals who are severely obese. So that even poses a greater, there will be even a greater risk for other health conditions and also healthcare costs.
I wonder how many of us even know what our body mass index is and know whether or not we're obese or severely obese. Do we know?
That's a great question. So body mass index, also referred to as BMI, there's a formula for it, and I won't give you the exact formula because it probably won't mean much to you. But if you go online, for example, on the CDC.gov website or even just Google BMI calculator, you'll be able to, if you enter your weight and your height, it will tell you what your BMI is.
Mm-hmm.
And the cutoff points that I used normally is that a BMI below 25 means that this individual is at a normal weight. A BMI between 25 and 30 indicates that a person is overweight. And then a BMI of 30 and greater means that the person is obese. A couple of things to note, to be careful with BMI calculations, are that, first of all, the cutoff points that I just described are for adults only. Children have different cutoff points, and if you go into the BMI calculators and try to calculate the obesity or overweight status for a child, you also have to enter that child's weight, age and sex, because the cutoff points for children are dependent on age and sex as well, where for adults they're not. It's just based on your height and weight. Another issue with BMI, we always say it's not a perfect measurement of your overweight or obesity status. You know, a lot of athletes, if they use this BMI calculator, they can actually be categorized as obese, but in fact they're not. It's just that their muscle weight is what's contributing to their BMI being higher. So it's not a perfect measurement of BMI, of obesity, but that's kind of the best that we can use at this point. So there's kind of, you have to be careful when you think about BMI.
Olga, what about children? We've heard studies recently about the number of children who are overweight and obese mm-hmm. in this country and how they may not live as long as their parents have. Did you study that population? Is it increasing at an alarming rate?
We, in this particular study that we were talking about earlier, we did not look at children specifically. But in the previous research, we have definitely seen that the obesity rates are going up dramatically for children. And the problem is that obesity in children who are obese at a younger age are more likely to remain obese as they get older. Mm. And so all of their health problems accumulate with that with time as well.
Mm-hmm. And why would that be? They just continue bad eating habits for their lifetimes?
It depends. Obesity has a lot of causes. It's hard to say that it's just the bad eating or there's a lot of different things that are causing it. But overall, I would say that it's probably the lifestyles that these individuals lead. And it's just once you gain the weight, it's a lot more difficult to lose it and keep it off rather than just prevent yourself from gaining it in the first place.
Let's start taking phone calls. I know there's great concern about this issue, and there are a number of very well-meaning people who would like to lose weight. And so let's delve right into phone calls and emails. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our guest, the first part of the show, is Olga Havshu, a research economist from RTI International, a nonprofit research institute headquartered in North Carolina. And they just did this study, Obesity and Severe Obesity Forecasts Through 2030. Dee Dee in Waukesha is our first caller. Hi, Dee Dee.
Hi. Hi, Olga. I know recently they changed the acceptable BMI for what's considered obese, and I'm just wondering if that's going to affect the study or has affected the study going forward. People who probably weren't considered obese now are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that means that probably, you know, the rates will be going even higher because now we're including more people into the obesity category. So the growth rate may not necessarily change, but every year there'll be the number of people will be more and more who are in those categories.
Will it change, you know, the more people that are considered obese, the number's going to go down, or, you know, what the acceptable level? Is that going to change as they realize how obesity affects health, or do you have any idea on that?
No, I'm not really sure.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. It's an interesting topic.
Thanks, Dee Dee. Here's an email from Steve. Is there a direct correlation between obesity and poverty? Are poor people fatter, rich people thinner?
There is definitely some evidence in the developed countries that the socioeconomic status is related to obesity, so that the lower your income is, the more likely you are to be obese. And part of it is, at least one of the potential reasons for that is that people with lower incomes cannot afford to make healthy choices, to eat healthier, or, you know, join gyms and exercise more. So there's definitely a correlation between those two.
Albert in Milwaukee. Hi, Albert.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, Albert, how are you?
I'm all right. I just had a comment about the health issue. I believe people just don't want to talk about it. It's a very sensitive subject for people. I'm African American, and you know, my community has a high blood pressure population skyrocketing, and I believe it's the food choices, of course. Inactivity. I try to get my pregnant wife to understand that you just can't eat anything because nowadays we got autism that's involved with obesity and being pregnant. Just a lot to say about that, and people really don't even recognize the health risk that it takes on not only yourself, but also unborn children, and I'm just flabbergasted because even the pediatric doctors don't even want to explain to the women in my case, because I go to the doctor and I don't hear anything about, you know, you need to watch your weight, or watch what you're eating. I don't know, even know how to explain. how else I feel about it, but I'm real passionate about that because we really need to recognize that it's a problem, and it's only getting worse.
Have we tuned it all out, Olga?
Well, I think that's a great point, and I think education is an extremely important part of it. You know, we need to educate the public on the potential problems that the obesity carries with it. And then it's definitely going through the healthcare system as well, you know, having doctors talk to their patients. And like you mentioned, it is a concern sometimes that not all doctors feel comfortable discussing this issue with their patients. So that's definitely one of the things that I think should be addressed.
Mm-hmm. And what about his point that people just don't seem to want to take on this issue personally, either because it's a very personal issue and they don't want attention brought to their weight, or because the messages are out there, Olga, but people seem to be not listening to them.
I mean, I think it's at this point, it's, you know, everybody will probably agree with me that, you know, losing weight is not an easy thing. So I think for a lot of people, it's just such a big thing to tackle, and they're, you know, they just don't want to do it for one reason or another. One of the things that I think is important is that we need to be making healthy choices more accessible and more available to encourage people to want to make those choices. And from an economic standpoint, one of the ways to make those choices available is, you know, to change the relative pricing. And so basically you need to make the healthy options cheaper compared to unhealthy options in order for people to choose them.
Mm-hmm. More phone calls in a moment. We're looking at the obesity rate in this country and the latest study, which has just come out, which was published just last week in the on behalf of the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, obesity and severe obesity forecast through 2030. It shows that the rates have increased dramatically, as we know, but the numbers just are incredible here. Severe obesity will continue to be a very big problem. It's increased the rates faster than obesity with no evidence of slowing. The obesity rates will continue to grow as well, but there has been, according to this study, an indication of slower growth in that rate. The study also looked at the huge medical expenditures that we will have as a result of excess weight. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email is talk@wpr.org. A little bit later, we'll speak with a nutritionist about what it is you can do to tackle obesity or being overweight yourself. And we'll also be speaking with an investigator from the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases about why it is, a little bit more about why we have an obesity epidemic. Part of what this doctor says is that we have an overproduction of food in the United States. There's a viewpoint I haven't heard before. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, we're going to have some fun. The Midwest Women's Sailing Conference is taking place in Milwaukee. It's the second annual. It's this Saturday at the Milwaukee Community Sailing Center. We'll be speaking with a couple guests, the conference keynote speaker who has circumnavigated the world two times as the captain of an all-female crew. We'll also speak with a high school senior from Milwaukee who's a member of Team Rafiki, which is competing in this year's J30 North American Championships. Back to phone calls. Randy in Lavelle. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. Say, thank you for the program. I have a very specific question. At one time, I had a BMI of 46. I now have a BMI of 26.
Oh, my. Good for you.
Congratulations.
I was fortunate. I got into an experimental program there at the UW and intensively taught me good nutrition and so on. Over 20 years have maintained this. I'm told it's very rare, only like 4 or 5 of the 2,000 that participated have done that. Now, ma'am, what my question is BMI now going to be the driver of medical benefits under the new law? If so, I'm very much against that because it looks like when I go to the doctor, I'm incredibly healthy. Where really, if I stopped, that weight is following me around like a bad relative, you know.
That's a great question. I actually do not know whether the BMI is what's going to be used for that. So, unfortunately, I'm sorry, but I can't really give you a good answer to that question.
Well, let me ask you, do you think that this should be something that is regularly taken when we go for, you know, a cold or for anything, that our we should know what our BMI is, that physicians should pay attention to that always?
I think that would be great. I mean, for individually, you can also just track your weight because your height probably won't be changing unless you're getting older. And but as an adult, I think personally tracking weight alone is probably just fine as long as you know what your BMI is at baseline.
Mm-hmm.
And also, too, one thing that I forgot to mention when I was talking about the BMI and the cutoff points, one example that I can give you is, because just saying BMI 25 or BMI of 30 doesn't really mean anything to a lot of people. So somebody who is 5'3", if they weigh 140 pounds, that puts their BMI right on the border of 25. So that's kind of for you to know what the cutoff is for being overweight. It's not obese, it's just being overweight.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Randy, very much for the call. And Kristen from La Crosse, hi.
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 I just wanted to say, you know, I'm a physician in La Crosse, and I deal with this on a daily basis. And I think it's wrong of physicians not to address the obesity issue, because that's the predominant problem that I see with the majority of my patients. The, you know, like you discussed, it's multiple health problems that, you know, come from the obesity itself. You know, I've sort of come across the term sick fat or adiposopathy, and I find it fascinating that this abdominal fat that we see on a lot of our patients is a hormone factory, really, and contributes to a lot of these health problems. So what I just wanted to say was I think it's absolutely necessary to empower patients with the information that they need to lose weight. And it's not just go out and diet, because that doesn't mm-hmm. work. We know that doesn't work. It's the food choices, like some other callers have discussed. That is how we are going to enable these people to lose weight. They have to be careful about their food choices. Like you said, and it's the healthy food choices. And I really am a firm believer in more of a plant-based whole foods concept. I don't know what you think about that, but I really think that that is the only way we're going to get around this problem.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that?
I completely agree. I definitely think that physicians play a very important role in encouraging their patients and kind of educating them about how big this problem really is for them, and how, you know, what kind of health adverse events it could potentially lead to. And there's... I don't think that there's one answer to how reduce obesity or prevent obesity rates. I think it's going to be kind of a number of different strategies and approaches and interventions that we'll have to implement and work with in order for anything to make a difference. But I definitely do agree that making healthy food choices available is one of the very important things.
And thank you, Olga, very much for doing this study and for being with us to outline it.
Thank you very much for having me on this show.
Olga Havshu, research economist from RTI International. You can go online and just Google obesity and severe obesity forecasts through 2030. It was published on behalf of the American Journal of Preventive Medicine, and the study is found there. We move to a deeper discussion of the obvious question, how do people lose weight? How do we take on this obesity epidemic in this country? Because it's not good for us, and it's going to result in huge health care costs. We have two guests with us now. Lisa Young, nutritionist in New York City and an adjunct professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at New York University. Lisa is the author of The Portion Teller Plan and is an expert on portion sizes. Her research interests focus on the contribution of increasing portion sizes to the U.S. obesity epidemic and its implications for nutrition education and public policy. Lisa, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's important for us to know, now that we know how bad this problem is, what the world we're going to do about
bad.
It. Right. Yeah, it is
yes.
bad. Carson Chow is also with us, investigator for the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, adjunct professor, Department of Mathematics at the University of Pittsburgh. And thank you, Carson Chow, very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So let's start with portion control. It is amazing how much we eat now. When you go out to eat, when you go to a fast food restaurant, wherever you go, you get huge portions. You sit down to eat at the family table and you don't eat what you used to eat when I was growing up. You eat a lot more. Is that a huge part of the obesity problem,
Lisa?
Oh,
it's absolutely one of the major contributing factors to the obesity problem. And food portions today are about 2 to 5 times larger than they were.
Wow.
Just 50, 60 years ago.
Wow. And you
Yeah.
And you would say, Dr. Chow, part of the reason for that is that we produce too much food in this country. We haven't heard that very much.
It's quite amazing that from 1975 to now, we produce on the order of 1,000 more calories per person per day. So literally half our nutritional requirements have been increased. And that's per person, so that's not accounting for the increase in the population.
Mm-hmm. What do you recommend, Lisa, in terms of how much we should be eating? How do we figure out what the portion size is that's right for us? How do we enjoy some foods? And, you know, we're not going to give up a little bit of chocolate, a little cake, you know, some of the foods that are fun to eat. We're not going to do that and just eat a totally, totally healthy diet. But how do we decide what portion?
Well, you know, I look at it as there's foods that we can eat more of and there's foods that we should eat less of. And I totally agree with you about giving up the chocolate and the piece of cake. But if we sort of take a plate and fill it with half fruits and vegetables, which are nutrient dense, low in calories, and they're not going to break us in the bank in terms of weight gain, and then we say, you know, I'm going to have a portion of meat, the size of my palm, maybe 2 palms, 1 to 2 decks of cards, but not 6 decks of cards, you know, which is the equivalent of what we're getting. And then we have some healthy starch. That's really looking at a healthy plate.
Mm-hmm.
And allowing a small portion of, you know, a treat of a piece of chocolate, a little piece of cake. But what happens is that our eyes are bigger than our stomach, and we eat quickly, and we eat whatever we're served, and we think that if the restaurant is serving it, it's an acceptable portion. But we have to stop, enjoy the company, and eat until we're comfortably full instead of uncomfortably stuffed, which is, in a sense, what we've been doing.
Mm-hmm. Carson, you've done some interesting work on what happens to our body as we lose weight and how long it takes for our body to reach some kind of equilibrium, which leads me to believe, you know, all these fad lose 10 pounds in 10 weeks just isn't going to cut it.
Oh, that's right. So we produced a mathematical model of how the body changes when it has change in food intake. So say you're at a stable weight and then you decide you want to eat 100 calories less, then you will eventually stabilize, and this is on average, so it will change depending on the person, like 10 pounds. You'll lose eventually 10 pounds, but it'll take about 3 years to get there, and then you'll plateau at that new weight. So so what happens a lot is that if you drop your calories drastically or you go on an intense exercise program, you can lose weight really quickly. And but then what people do is they lose weight really quickly and they hit their target weight. Then they think, okay, then they start to eat like they used to eat.
Right.
They think, oh, great, I can maintain this weight and be like I lived before. And then 3 years later, they're suddenly back, and then they'll say, oh, I didn't change. How did I catch up? And the reason they didn't notice it is because your body responds really, really slowly. So obviously if you fast for 6 weeks, you'll lose a lot of weight. But then the ultimate steady state if you fasted would be, you know, zero. So... So it's these really, really slow changes that I think that vexes diets. And it also makes it really hard to tell whether you're eating more or less because your body is responding so slowly. It's like if you're in the shower and you're trying to, and you have this really, really slow hot water thing, right? And you can end up turning in hot, cold, and you never quite get it right. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. 100 calories a day would be what, Lisa?
So the old way people used to think about it was every 3,500 calories you eliminate is a pound. So that doesn't account for the fact that your body's metabolic requirements change as you start to lose weight. So the new rule of thumb, and this is just a rule of thumb, it may not work for everyone, is every 10 calories that you reduce from a previous steady state will result in an eventual 1 pound loss, but it will take about 3 years to get there.
Is that fast enough, Lisa?
Well, I mean, the issue is we sort of have to start somewhere. And one of the things that, you know, I like about sort of extrapolating that is to just say, okay, a tablespoon of oil is 100 calories. You know, a piece of bread, 100 calories. Half a cup of pasta, 100 calories. Somewhere in that range. So let's slowly start to scale back and leave over some food, you know, a bagel, 400 calories, because it's like five pieces of bread.
Oh, my goodness. It's that many calories. Wow.
400, because it's taking five pieces of bread and mushing them together. You know, exactly what it is. But if we could sort of scale back, you know, the public is, you know, they're not scientists. So for them, you know, they could sort of get confused and we can lose the consumer. But if we just take that and extrapolate it and say it just means you need to cut back a little here and a little there without even feeling like you're on a diet, because we've got the movement towards low carb, low fat, high carb, high protein, and then that doesn't work in the long term. Even just soda, 100 calories, 8 ounces of soda or juice.
And then if you add just a little bit more exercise, Carson, you're on the road?
Yes. Exercise can compensate. So it's just total calories in. So if you exercise an extra 300 calories a day, then that's like eating 300 less. Although I must warn that the studies have shown that people respond to exercise in different ways. So some people don't eat more when they exercise, so they don't compensate, but other people will actually eat more, so they'll just kind of like, you know, just zero sum out the exercise. So they'll exercise, you know, 300 calories and then have an oatmeal cookie to compensate. So then it doesn't matter again.
And sometimes that oatmeal cookie or chocolate chip or whatever is at a facility that's right next door to the place where you exercise.
Right.
Which is problematic. I've been there. What do both of you make of these obesity studies? I mean, this is really alarming news, the number of people who are obese and the high cost of medical care, all of the diseases related to obesity. Just your general thoughts about that and whether or not you think we're getting this message as Americans and need to do something about it. Lisa?
You know, I was at the conference, the Weight of the Nation conference at the CDC last week when they released the report.
Mm-hmm.
And they released their report on Monday, and then on Tuesday, the Institute of Medicine report was released, where we need to really take a stronger step in prevention. And issues like the role of the environment, having healthy foods available everywhere, limiting marketing, food marketing to kids, having healthy foods available for kids, adding more exercise, and integrating the physician, the health professional, the insurance company, and the employers. So it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all approach, but we've got to really integrate and work with the entire community on this.
Carson, what do you think?
I agree. It's there will not be an easy fix. It is a the problem is you have to eat every day, so it's controlling something that you already have to do. It's not like quitting smoking. I would like to add that one of the most difficult things is that people really don't know how much they eat every day. There was a study done in the 70s where a bunch of nutritionists actually tracked what they ate for an entire year, and they found that the variation was huge. I mean, they would, you know, on some days they would eat 600 calories, another day they would eat 4,000 calories, even though the average was around 2,000. So it's wildly varying, so it's very difficult to keep track of these things.
So you're saying we should keep track of it?
If you can, but there's also studies that show that even people who claim that they're keeping track, you know, really religiously of what they're eating, they still make errors, and the errors are large enough that it could easily be 20, 30 pounds.
Ooh.
Because it's like, you know, if you're off by 300 calories a day, that's possibly 30 pounds difference in weight.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and let me tell you where the errors are coming from. The errors are coming from the fact that, you know, you ask someone how much did you eat. There's all these apps to help track your calories, but they're based on portion sizes that nobody eats anymore. And we're eating at least double what we think we're eating. And then we also, because we're eating out, we don't realize that there's going to be a half a stick of butter.
Right.
In the pasta portion
right.
that was prepared by somebody else.
Right.
And that's the problem. We've lost control over how our food is being prepared because we don't cook, we don't eat home.
Let's go to phone calls. Our number, by the way, one line is open, 800-486-8655. Jerry in Menasha, hi.
Hi, I want to take issue with the statement that we're growing too much food in this country. If this is true, why are we importing half our food and from countries that use herbicides and insecticides that are illegal here? This business of overweight has caused One, by poverty. Two, the very fact that the foods that are most satisfying in your stomach are protein foods with a little fat with them, and those are the expensive foods. Those are the foods because the protein matter stays in your stomach longer and you're much more satisfied. You have to eat a lot more starch and carbohydrate to get that feeling, and it still doesn't stay there that long. So there's kind of a chemical mix-up here, and we get this advice invariably from young people, bless their hearts, they're well-educated, but they have never faced ethnic backgrounds that when you were a child, being fat meant you were healthy. And we still have some of that hangover, although there are some generations that have gone by from that. But I would like your guest to come.
Carson, why don't you start?
It is true that we import a lot of food, and we also export food. What I'm talking about is the U.S. Department of Agriculture keeps track of the food available per person per capita. So this is the food that is subtracting all that goes to pet food, all that's lost by rats eating it and pests destroying it. So this is the food that actually makes it to market either to grocery stores or restaurants. And the data simply shows that the amount of food available per person per day has gone up from about 3,000 calories in 1975 to over 3,600 calories today, or at least in 2005. So, I mean, it's gone up quite a bit. The average American, if you using our mathematical model, which is a metabolic model, it's calibrated on actual physiological changes. So we do careful. They've done careful studies where they take people, they control what they diet, so that you're locked in this submarine kind of thing where your food is metered out to you, and then we measure what happens to your body weight and your energy expenditure as you change your diet. And so we calibrated the model to these physiological parameters, so they're not epidemiological-based things. And we simply show that the food that's available, if you fed everything to the U.S. population and all of it was consumed, we would be even more obese than we are today. So the implication is that we waste a lot of food. So, I mean, it's I know a lot of people don't like this message, and I get criticized for it a lot, but I actually don't have a personal agenda. In fact, I didn't believe that this was true. We literally had a model for the human person, and we took, okay, let's take the average American, and then we had the food data. I simply said, let's feed the data, the food that's available to the model and see what happens, and it was like, I was shocked. In fact, it took us. I delayed publishing the paper for 2 years because
really?
I didn't believe the results. I kept on going back and forcing my collaborators to get a different answer.
That's fascinating.
It's not like I have this agenda that I'm against American food. I think that that there was a huge benefit to a lower cost than food is that malnutrition has been, severly decreased in the country.
Thank you very much, Jerry, for the call. Lisa, let's put this one your way. Wendy Sue in Appleton writes, much of the food in grocery stores is not food. It's high calorie, nutritionally deficient, chemically altered, sweetened carbohydrate, deliberately engineered to be addictive. People's bodies are craving real food, but our brains and taste buds have been trained to crave chemicals.
Well, there's a lot of truth to that, and one of the issues is we are eating processed junk food, which can stay on the shelves for an unlimited amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, whole foods don't bear labels that say, eat me, so you don't see them heavily advertised at the Super Bowl or any place else. And there is a body of research that does believe that for many people, not necessarily everyone, but for many people, the high sugar, high fat, high salt content of these foods cause you, in a sense, to crave more of these foods. Now, if we were to eat a more plant-based diet with whole grains that have a lot of fiber is satiating. It helps you feel full, so it's a signal to stop. But this junk that we're eating that's so heavily processed just is sort of an eat more message, and we just eat and eat and eat. And there's also a dual role between the role of the food industry, where they need to sell food, so they want to sell more food, and the more we buy, the better it is for them, but then the fatter we are.
And Carson, so, I know that you have called for us to stop marketing food to children.
Well, one of the things that we found that is that once a person becomes obese, it is extremely difficult for them to lose weight and keep it off. I mean, really what they have to do is they have to essentially go on a diet and stay on it for the rest of their life and be vigilant.
Oh, my.
I mean, the studies that have been done that shown that people that have successfully lost weight and kept it off really have completely changed their lifestyle, and they are vigilant every single day. They watch what they eat. They make sure they exercise.
Mm-hmm.
They do a lot of things that Lisa mentioned. So, I lost my train of thought. What was the question again?
It's all right. It's marketing for children.
Oh, marketing. Absolutely. So, what things we have to do is prevent. I think what we have to do is prevent people from becoming obese, and so we have to start with children. That's why I think stopping food marketing to children might be a good place to start. Although I'm not a sociologist, I'm not an economist. This is just a personal opinion.
Well, and you can see it. We all see it in our families, even though we try to eat right and put the right foods on the table. Where do kids want to go? It's to McDonald's or Taco Bell or all of those places. It's a very, and you don't know where exactly they got it. It must be through marketing. It's also
television.
television and also their peer group. That's the neat place to go. That's the food that they like to eat. I've never been able to totally figure it out.
Absolutely.
I agree. Absolutely. And it's fun, and there's cartoon characters. And if there's not a cartoon character on the carrots, you don't want to eat them. Kids don't want to eat them.
Well, we need cartoon characters. We need our carrots to be cartoon characters, right? I don't know.
No, I think we need to train kids that, you know, whole foods, unprocessed foods are the way to go, and that
right.
we don't need to eat foods that have cartoon characters and that are not heavily advertised. But parents are busy. Moms are working, and they just give in.
Yeah. Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. We're looking at the obesity epidemic this hour, and this particular half hour we're looking at how do we combat it. We have two guests with us. Lisa Young is a nutritionist and adjunct professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU, and author of The Portion Teller Plan. Carson Chow, investigator with the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Diseases, adjunct professor in the Department of Mathematics at the University of Pittsburgh. We also have an email, which is talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page to leave comments as well. And maybe words of inspiration. We always like to hear those stories, like our earlier call of somebody whose BMI went down some 20 points. What do you do? How can you inspire others to get healthier? 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next call is Margie in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Margie.
Hi. You've had a lot of ideas of how people should be eating and everything, but some of your guests have already addressed some of the issues I was concerned about is poverty. I had problems for several years with weight gain and loss, up and down, and I was diagnosed with diabetes, and so I went on a diabetic diet. I lost 30 pounds in a year, and I was feeling really good about that until, because of my low income, and I was 64 years old and retired and not eligible for Medicare, so I had to go to the free clinic, and one of the nurse practitioners there ordered a test for thyroid, and they said, no, your weight loss was not due to diabetic diet, it was hyperthyroidism. And so I'm currently dealing with that. Now they've killed off my thyroid, and I've put on 20 pounds again in 4 months here.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
And I will get straightened out on that, but I have no idea at this point what my true weight is. And I've got a daughter that was manic depressive, and they put her on all kinds of antidepressants and Depakote. and she just ballooned.
Yeah, Margie, stay with us. We're going to go to another caller who has a question about weight and illness, and then we'll have our guests respond to both of you. Thank you very much for your call. Lori in Mineral Point, hi.
Hi. Yes, I can relate to the last caller. I was diagnosed 2 years ago with Graves' disease. They, like she said, killed my thyroid. Now I'm on thyroid replacement hormones. But what my problem is, over 15 years ago, I lost weight. I kept it off diligently up until this Graves' disease and when they killed my thyroid. And I feel like doctors are very unresponsive to people that have... I know I probably don't get as much exercise as I should, but I work a lot of hours, so it's very hard for me to get the exercise I need. I try to watch everything I eat. I mean, once in a while I partake in a goodie, but if you don't, then someday you sit down and you want to gorge on it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's get some response. Carson, let's start with you. I'd like to hear both of you respond to this.
Yeah, the thyroid is one of the important organs to maintain your energy expenditure. So if you have a thyroid deficiency, then your energy expenditure will go down. So then that means your energy requirements will go down. So it's a very difficult thing, and I sympathize with both the callers that it'd be really hard to adjust to a new life where you're burning less energy and the medication may make it go up and down. So, I mean, it's just difficult, and I think, yes, I agree that the medical profession, you know, it needs to be more proactive in these types of things, and there's really nothing that I, you know, I'm not an MD, so I couldn't provide any advice directly, but...
All right, Lisa.
You know, I'm a registered dietitian, and I work with a lot of physicians and counsel patients who... you know, have such conditions. And what happens with situations like getting thyroid disease or going on a medication for a mental illness or going through menopause is that we are used to eating a certain amount of food. And when you get this illness, you can't eat the same way. And you're sort of left with, I'm going to be starving. I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so... the first thing that's required is some sympathy and empathy for the patient because there is something that is really going on. The challenge is to work with patients where they eat fewer calories but eat healthier options and fill up on more plant-based fruits, vegetables, whole grains so that they don't have to be deprived. But the issue is when you eat out, it's hard to get that food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really making small changes and, number one, recognizing that problem, that there is something going on and that you're going to have to shift and eat fewer calories. But maybe you don't have to eat so much less. You want to eat less of the junk food and more of the healthy food.
And thank
carrots,
you.
Carrots and lettuce doesn't cause weight gain.
Carrots and lettuce, right.
You know, and even a piece of chicken or fish. So it's what
yeah.
causes weight gain, the junk food. And that's where it becomes so difficult for patients.
Thank you, Margie, and thank you, Lori. Maria in Milwaukee, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Maria.
Hi. Thank you for all what you have said. I think there's something really important that it hasn't been addressed. There's a very wrong message about people that are obese are not healthy and people that are thin are healthy. I'm a professor at UWM, and I see my students that are very overweight or obese eating the same kind of things that they thin students, that the skinny students eat. And so what I'm saying is that we are all eating badly, and because there's this standard of beauty, of looking thin, people are saying, okay, the people that are obese are in a bad condition, but we are all eating badly, and that's a very important message that should be address that is not related only to be obese. Like thin and skinny people are eating badly, but their metabolisms are different, but there's something bad going on in their bodies.
I think you make an important point that we're all eating badly. Many of us are. Lisa?
I totally agree, and what's happening is often we reduce things to a simple BMI. You're overweight, so therefore you're eating unhealthy, and we're looking at the thin person and saying, oh, you know, you're healthy. But we also have these mixed messages where you have, you know, Miss America getting skinnier and skinnier and skinnier, the average person getting bigger, and then the eating disorders and the slew of things that are going on with teenagers.
Yes.
And kids that are either overeating or they're doing fad diets and starving and taking laxatives at 14 years old.
Oh, my. Thank you both so much for being with us. The conversation goes on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Lisa Young, nutritionist, adjunct professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health at NYU. She is author of The Portion Teller Plan, which you may have heard about. Carson Chow, investigator with the National Institute of Diabetes and Digestive and Kidney Disorders. He's at the University of Pittsburgh. And we thank earlier Olga Havzhu, research economist from RTI International, which was looking at the obesity epidemic and taking it out to the year 2030. Thanks to Brett Jaspers for producing, and Rhonda Fanning as well this hour. Thanks to Brett for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up, and then we have a really, what should be a fun show about sailing, and particularly women in sailing, so please stay with us. Thanks for listening.